Any instance of change is usually just one point on a much longer journey. But how does change happen? Whether it's in public opinion, legislation, our behaviour, our communities, or just one person's life? That's our question. This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. In 2015, the campaign to save the Joiners Arms, a much-loved LGBTQ plus venue in East London, was launched. Developers had sought to shut it down to make way for luxury flats. Since then, the Friends of the Joiners Arms have fought to save their venue as an asset of community value and to keep the spirit of the pub alive until it can reopen. Of course, the actors in any social change are themselves on a journey. Even natural allies will have different approaches to the same problem and different ideas about the end game. So, to discuss the story so far of the campaign to save the Joiners Arms, we're joined by Dwayne Clark, himself a planner. He became involved in the project relatively recently. John Pearce, local councillor in the Joiners Arms neighbourhood, and Liam Barrington Bush, a community organiser who has worked in both London and Toronto. We first looked at people's individual experience. What was going on that motivated people to step up? Here's Dwayne Clark.
I wasn't there right at the beginning. From what I've heard and what my colleagues have told me is, I guess the initial catalyst was we just wanted somewhere to party. You know, we'd lost a club or a bar that we were used to going out to every weekend with our friends, and we found ourselves in a position where we no longer had that place. So I'd say that was the main catalyst of what motivated us. What was happening around that, I guess, you know, we all live in and around London, and we see clubs and bars shutting down every week. We see gentrification, we see housing prices. I guess people who frequent places like the Joiners felt generally that they were often being pushed by society and losing out on spaces, whether it's living spaces or places that we like to socialise. Spaces in general felt that they were being taken away from us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. Do you want to build on that?
Yeah, so I was, John, one of the local councillors, I was involved from the start. David Pollard ran the Joiners Arms, and he was a local resident and, you know, had done fantastic work in the community through the bar for a number of years, and I'd been involved with him previously. There was a number of issues around licensing and so on with the bar. The police wanted to have a review of the license and put in really punitive measures, which thankfully were seen off. But then a year or so later, we then heard that, you know, the Joiners were being closed down because of redevelopments. And I think at the time, locally in the ward, but in London, it was back in 2014, 2015, I think, you know, we had Boris Johnson as the mayor of London and the Conservative government, you know, and in housing terms, they'd stopped funding social housing. They brought in an 80% affordable rent model. And so people in London were getting very concerned about housing and the reality of the situation. Locally, in the town hall, Tower Hamlets Council was in a really, really difficult position. You might have seen what happened in Tower Hamlets in that time, and you know, this is a political opinion, but we had an independent, probably really interestingly, a populist local mayor who was quite controversial, and the government ended up taking over the council, and then subsequently after the 2014 local election, a high court ruled that that election was void because of election fraud, and there's subsequently now a Labour mayor. So in the community in Tower Hamlets, it was really fraught at the time, but also there was a real challenge in London around housing, and it's not up until I think the 2015 general election really that housing became like an issue again for national politicians. Many general elections before then, nobody talked about housing. And when the Conservatives did that massive cut to social housing, that was the first time in about 50 years the funding had been cut. Was it in the papers? Did people know about it? Were people worried about it? Were people on the streets saying this is a fundamental element of our welfare state that is stopping now? You know, people just weren't engaged, and, you know, housing just wasn't on the agenda. And just in the area and in that community, so it's a part of what people see as Shoreditch, and there's been a lot of stuff happening locally. We had the serial killers CAF move into Brick Lane, which is also in my ward, and so there's a real debate around gentrification, what that means, specifically in this part of the country, because, you know, we had at one point a mob turn up and throw loads of paint on it. There's a real debate sort of happening in and around the community around, you know, what was our future? Where were we going to go? And a lot of people were struggling and suffering. You know, they still are today. But that was the sort of the context, and I feel, for where we were at within Tower Hamlets and within those specific neighbourhoods.
How far did the campaign start with a firm plan?
I don't imagine there was much of a plan short of we must save this space. And sometimes that's probably the only plan that you need, you know, by any means necessary, we have to keep this space.
Turning to the wider community, was public opinion in Tower Hamlets already supportive, or was it part of the campaign's work to build that?
There was a lot happening at the time around gentrification, what it meant. That debate is still happening. In terms of local opinion, a lot of people who I represent think of pubs as the nighttime economy. In that part of the Shoreditch and Bethnal Green, it's busy at weekends. You know, they wake up throughout the night because a lot of people who leave the pubs, you know, walk through their neighbourhoods, which 20 years were quite neighbourhoods. But now it's Shoreditch. You know, we've all been there. We've all walked through having fun with our friends and so on. But that does have an impact on the community. Would they have jumped out the door to save a local pub? I don't think so. I don't think the local community and the people who were right next to the Joiners Arms were up in arms. I think it was a wider campaign, and there was a wider debate within the LGBT plus community around, you know, our heritage and our sense of a loss of community and so on. You know, at the time, it was when equal marriage was going through. There was a national debate about the identity of gay people in our community today in Britain, and, you know, what it meant and so on. And there was that battle happening nationally. So I think, given where the LGBT community has been, where was public opinion on LGBT pubs? I would have said very supportive, actually, that people had now seen that they are a heritage asset in a community as important as mosques and churches to other communities, that's where the LGBT community was. And so I do think the campaign was sort of pushing through an open door in terms of the decision makers and in terms of the media and what was happening on social media. I think, you know, this type of issue got traction very quickly because of what was happening in the country, I think.
I'd certainly agree with that. I mean, trying to find support for the campaign within the LGBT community, I think, was always going to be the easier task. You know, we had the Royal Vauxhall Tavern. They had their community status established just before us. And what tends to happen when we lose spaces in our communities is it's often the spaces that are frequented by the marginalised communities. So, you know, we talk about gay pubs and gay spaces, or we talk about your church that perhaps doesn't have the same numbers as it used to have. It's these spaces that tend to be attacked, for want of a better word, first. So the LGBT community was always aware of these things happening in and around London, these closing of spaces and the threats. So I think to galvanise that section of the community was always going to be easy in terms of getting support from the wider general public. I think when you have a status like the Joiners Arms had it, and it being somewhat iconic, I think it's going to be slightly easier to pull people simply for its heritage status, you know.
Given that context, what communities or groups were drawn into the process of change?
I can't think of any that we reached out specifically, but wherever we went, we always found support. You know, it wasn't so much public support. And I think generally speaking, that goes if to link to the gentrification argument. You know, if you speak to the average person in the street, they're either going to be indifferent or they perhaps would support retaining whatever space is at threat. It's usually, sadly, it's the policymakers and the landowners and perhaps the other interested parties that tend to be a bit more confrontational in that respect.
Liam Barrington-Bush.
I guess I'm sort of curious as a follow-on question of, like, if there was a sort of a conscious point where the shift between having been this historical space for LGBTQ communities in the area and being like, we clearly need wider support on this. Often that's a sort of a phase in community-based campaigning where you kind of end up thinking like, how do we have to change in order to connect with a much wider community around. And I wonder if there were certain debates or conflicts that kind of came up around that, because I think those spaces where you're like, as a community, we know exactly what we want and what we want to protect. We know that also in order to make that message make sense with people around us more widely, that we might have to shift that a little bit. And that can sometimes be a tension. I'm curious if like if that was something that came up for either of you or you experienced in the campaign.
I think at the point where we, so it happened, and as has been said, other LGBT venues had been in the news that, you know, were at risk and so on. The Conservative government brought in these new powers, community rights, and one of them was, you know, the right for communities to designate buildings as assets of community value. And there's, from the first meeting, we sort of knew that that was what we wanted to do. Enough people in the room sort of had a sense that that was the approach you needed to take. And then there was sort of a process to trigger that power or to request a council to designate. You have to be a constituted group. So you have to have a structure and so on. So individuals can't do it. So that's why the Friends of the Joiners Arms was created, as a mechanism to be able to trigger that process within a council to see whether or not it would designate this space. And so I think that was the urgent thing from day one. We have a really networked local community. We've loads of different TRAs, and we've like groups of TRAs that sit on top of that. The Friends group did go out and engage, and you know, they were on various agendas and so on. I think that's a really good point about finding issues that are there in the community. So in that part, antisocial behaviour is a real big issue. So they're really loud and vocal when they need to be, which is brilliant to work with. But I don't, like, if the joiners group had sort of said, this is our issue and we care about antisocial behaviour too and we want to help you, you know, you would have filled a room. Do you know what I mean? That was the has always been the real issue for that community, and that's where, you know, people are concerned. So it's like, yeah, how do you meet in the middle?
Was it successful in drawing people in?
The meetings were really busy. Well, for community meetings, the meetings were really busy. I think there was about 30 people turning up, and they were quite frequent. It was weekly at the start. It was urgent. Action needed to be taken, and that was the sort of the status of it. Then there was a petition, there was loads of fantastic media work and a lot of attention within the gay community, but also like people were talking about, like, the joiners, it has huge significance for many LGBT people in London, one of those places that everyone has got to. So there was a real sort of emotional response to it from the community. And because of that, like, the meetings got busier and busier, but there was a process to happen. They needed to influence Tower Hamlets Council to see this premises as above other premises, having a cultural significance. That's why it needed to be given this status, which puts strict rules in terms of what an owner can do going forward to a building like that.
And how did all of these volunteers organise themselves? Dwayne Clark.
I guess the group's always had a, you know, a handful of people who have perhaps taken care of the more administrative side of things. But we kind of pride ourselves on not being particularly organised, at least from the outside point of view. So, you know, we never had a main spokesperson. We didn't have someone who dealt with all the public correspondence in solely, you know. Part of that perhaps was part of our success, you know. It made it difficult for the developers to single out individuals to cozy up to, for want of a better word. And in terms of organising and in terms of with Tower Hamlets Council, I think they would probably say we just continually badgered them. What you've got to remember is despite myself, I work in planning now, and I wasn't involved at that early stage, but no one has any planning experience who was a member of the Joiners Arms. No one had any experience of dealing with that kind of process. So it was a case of we learn on the job. We learn by speaking to local residents who maybe gave us some pointers about who to speak to in the council, or taking a particular planner who was part of that application and badgering that particular person and making sure that we was constantly in contact with them. Whether it was one particular member of the Joiners Arms or another person, it didn't matter who they spoke to, as long as the general overall message was, what can we do to push this along further?
This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. We're discussing the campaign to save the Joiners Arms, an iconic LGBTQ+ venue in East London. Taking part in this discussion are Joiners Arms activist Dwayne Clark, local councillor John Pearce, and community organiser Liam Barrington-Bush. Turning to actually getting the planning decision through, what were the critical events or actions that led to the successful decision? Dwayne Clark.
I'd say some of the media influence that we got, that certainly helped the campaign, people being aware. We'd done a lot of fundraising at different bars and clubs in and around Hackney Borough and to kind of fund the projects that we were doing. I guess the most critical thing was convincing Tower Hamlets that this place was important and they should do everything in their power to encourage the developer to amend their proposal in a way that ultimately led to safeguarding that space.
So how was the relationship with the council nurtured? Were relations good?
A lot of it was about just making sure that we were always on the other end of the line, and whenever we had a particular document or something to read through that was given to the council by the developers and we didn't understand it, we made sure that we understood it and drilled down and asked what that meant for us, etc., etc. They'd probably say that they tired of us after a while, but I think, and I'm speaking as a planner as well, I think there's this misconception that planners are obstructive and there's a lot of red tape and we're always, you know, not trying to obstruct these developers and developments regardless of what they are. And that's not true, you know. Generally speaking, and I've worked in two different planning offices, generally speaking, planners want to retain these spaces. They want to build affordable housing, which is a hot debate. But it's, as I said, it's the policymakers and it's the environment that we find ourselves in that means sometimes that planners do have decisions and make decisions that perhaps the general public don't agree with. Generally speaking, planners want to retain these spaces, and you'd probably say the same as councillors as well. You know, we want to keep these spaces.
And what of Councillor Pearce, who supports the campaign but is also an elected representative of the wider community?
I didn't sit on the committee that night. I was there, and because I'd been involved in creating an asset of community value, I think the test is the public. Have I an opinion on the future of that pub? I think I do. So I took myself off that decision. But yeah, I think planners would really love the community to engage in decisions and so on, to have a constructive discussion around it and to go through the process and rightly, you know, lobbying them as much as possible and lobbying the developer. You know, developers want to get a scheme true. They want to engage with the community and win them over so that they can go to a planning committee where we decide and say everyone's on board and nobody's objecting. And that is looked at as part of the decision making, you know. And so there is a process for that. There's a very clear process. The planning authority sits out of the council. It's a separate thing. And so, you know, the council would have designated the asset. The planners would have taken it through the process. But I think in planning terms, given the loss of a number of significant premises and clubs and the stuff around the Ministry of Sound and the noise issue, the George Tavern in Stepney, I think planning policy sort of caught up with what's happening in London. And so, like, the Mayor of London is now doing the new London plan and we're doing our own local plan, and there's real sort of weight now for local pubs. You know, we lost a few, and now we've caught up and we're putting policies in place to protect them. And what happened with the Joiners was, you know, seminal in terms of planning policy, because I think a few pubs had, you know, developers said, oh, we'll open it up and we'll make all of this lovely things happen. And then you're like, who is going to pay for that? And that was really interesting about this decision. The developer will pay for that, and they'll pay for the installation, and they will ensure for 25 years as an LGBT venue. You know, that was didn't happen 2 years before that. And so, yeah, it was a fantastic campaign to achieve that. And the community group just hammering home and not giving up would have made that happen, along with a real sense that we now need to ensure planning policy protects pubs and LGBT venues.
We turn to Liam Barrington-Bush for his reflections as a community organiser.
I guess I'm curious a little bit. Dwayne, you're doing planning work now, and John, you've been on the council for some time. I wonder, particularly with the declaring the pub as an asset of community value, I think one of the things I've come across a lot in a lot of community-based campaigning is the relationship with the council is partly dependent on if you have people who know how to operate the council. And that's always a relatively tiny number of people in almost any community I've been a part of. And so I guess I'm a bit curious that series of developments, both in terms of the pub itself and in terms of setting some of those precedents around protecting pubs and LGBTQ spaces, seem huge victories. How important was it sort of having people with that, the particular kind of experience amongst your group, who would be able to navigate those systems as effectively as you did?
Without sounding somewhat cocky, I don't think it was particularly significant, because we didn't have anyone. Like I said, me aside, I joined the campaign at the committee meeting. So we had already gone through 2.5 years of constant lobbying. So it would be wrong to say they draw upon my planning expertise or any knowledge that I had of navigating the planning system at all. We didn't have that. The critical thing that I found with us was we were just relentless. We just constantly... It was never good enough, you know, initially, when they were making some offers and, you know, would give you this space and would give you that, and it just never was good enough, because our ultimate objective was safeguarding the joiners, and anything less than that was a loss for us. What we are very good at is identifying individual skill sets, and therefore those individuals would be solely focused on that. You know, at the moment we're going through the process of planning how we're going to fit out this space when we get it, and talking to different architects and designers and stuff, and those people who therefore are motivated by that type of role are the players who are involved in that process, you know. And then we have a fundraising arm, and then, so for example, I'm a DJ, so I may well be involved in the fundraising or putting on nights elsewhere. So depending on your skill sets would determine on where you would go, and that's something that we've been good at.
Having won the landmark planning decision to preserve an LGBTQ plus venue on the site, what's next? When will the Joiners Arms reopen?
Getting the planning condition was only the beginning, you know. Safeguarding the space and what we've done is monumental, and as great as it is, that's just the beginning. You know, we have to plan this space and how the Joiners Arms was a pub or a club, however you want to call it. We want to keep that space, but we also want to expand it to the rest of the community. We would like it to be a space that's not open just at night on a, you know, Thursday to Sunday. We'd like it to be a space perhaps that's open throughout the day, and maybe have some charities come in, some LGBT charities maybe can use that space when it's not being used as a... These are all ideas that we're working on and developing, and something that we have to think about. I guess a lot of the hard work is done in terms of development. Respectively, we both know where we stand, we both know what their obligations are, and we know what we have to do to ensure that they stick to those obligations. So it's kind of a done deal. There's no arguing about how much floor space we're going to get, because we know that already, you know. So in terms of the relationship with the developer, I think it's professional.
But there's a catch.
Just because they have permission to develop that site doesn't mean they have to develop it, right? And without prejudice in the... Or wishing bad things upon it. There's no guarantee, even at this stage, that we are going to have that space. They don't have to build it.
Liam Barrington Bush.
I guess this is the kind of thing that the developer dynamic so often brings up in communities around London, that there are points in which developers become more vulnerable to making commitments, making public statements. But the examples of how that carries through or is followed through on, I think, often followed a quite a negative trajectory. And I think, like, interested to hear from both of you about, like, what does accountability look like? Developers will often come in by saying, we're going to replace like for like, we're going to make sure that what exists now is going to exist in the future. A few months pass by, there's some meetings, and then they're like, well, actually, we've decided that that's not quite possible, but we're going to have 80% of what was there, whether it was housing or mixed types of businesses. And you watch a few steps down the line, and then there's this whole process of developers trading over, flipping developments themselves from one to the next. Someone takes on demolition, someone else takes on the first step of building, and like each time costs go up, something gets sidelined. I'm curious to hear what does collective accountability look like to hold them to account? Because at the end of the day, developers are there because they're trying to maximize the profit they want to make out of a particular place. And there can be better or worse people that you deal with within them, but that is an interest that's not the same as wanting to have a community space or wanting to have a community more widely.
And that's a question for the campaign. Like, that developer needs to get on site and start building if you want that to happen. And you need to have that frank conversation with them, because they will have a whole portfolio of schemes across the country and so on, depending on who they are. And to be honest, people are critical of developers, but they did a good job for you and your campaign and a good job for the community.
Finally, given the explosion of local campaigns to resist the most damaging aspects of gentrification, how can campaigners have each other's backs? Liam Barrington-Bush.
When you're involved in something local, the vast majority of your attention has to be in that thing. But keeping your head up enough to say, okay, like, what can we do with the time, resources, the energy we have to also make sure we're connecting with and supporting and being there for other folks who are in similar positions, I think is one of the ongoing balancing acts of local campaigning. But I think it's the thing that helps them survive ultimately a lot of the time.
You've been listening to Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate, review and share it with a friend or colleague. You can find out more about the Social Change Project at www.smk.org.uk.